We are going through John 1, verses 1 through 18. So hear the word of the Lord. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him, not anything made. And without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me.' For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known." This is the word of the Lord. You can have a seat. Well, I particularly love the Christmas season, not because I love shopping or because I love all of the consumerism and the hype necessarily, but I love Christmas because in a disillusioned world of cynicism and apathy, we need wonder. We need to be in awe. And Christmas is a moment in our year where we remember and we celebrate that the impossible happened, that God himself became flesh and was born a baby. And so we sing songs about realities that our minds just cannot comprehend. We set up nativity scenes with our children and our grandchildren, and we tell them that the tiniest, weakest thing in the whole display is our hope, is the one who has come to save us, that a little baby is the one who will deliver us. You see, last week we saw that Christmas proclaims to us that we are all people lost in a very deep darkness. But God has come to shine light into the darkness to give us his grace. And yet, the message of Christmas has really been hijacked so that most people today assume that Christmas is really about the exact opposite. A couple years ago, the American Atheist Organization purchased billboards all over the country, and they put up billboards right around Christmas time encouraging people to go ahead and stay home from church on Christmas. And the one that I actually saw had Santa on it with his finger up at his lips with a little wink saying, "Go ahead, skip church, just be good for goodness sake." You see, the message is, go ahead and enjoy Christmas, just don't believe in Christmas. Because the assumption is that once you get rid of all of that nonsense about Jesus being born, Christmas is really just about all of us trying a little harder to be a little better, to let your little light shine just a bit brighter in the world. So be good. Just don't believe in some silly old fairy tale about God coming to save you. You see, our society has been seeking, like every society before, to separate the message of Christmas from the person of Christ. But you can't separate the person of Christ from the message of Christmas, because the message of Christmas is that Christ has come. It's really no surprise then, if you try to separate the message of Christmas from the person of Christ, you actually end up with the opposite of the real message of Christmas. So instead of wonder and awe of God coming to be with us to save us from our sin because we couldn't save ourselves, you end up with stories about elves spying on you from shelves. You end up with stories about old men who see everything you do and keep a tally of all the times that you pout and cry and shout, and we're told that you better be good if you want to get a gift. That you better get on the nice list if you want things to work out well. And these little ideas, they continue to shape your understanding even long after you stop setting out milk and cookies on Christmas Eve. We grow up thinking that if you want God to give you a gift, if you want blessings, then you better work hard to have a good life. You see, just notice how many times in your conversations or as you watch TV or listen to the radio this time of year, how often you hear someone say, "That's the real meaning of Christmas," or "That's what the holidays are all about." You're going to see it in every Christmas special, in every advertisement, that if you try a little harder to be a little better, then everything's going to work out in the end. But the meaning of Christmas is that it's not those who have earned it or deserve it. It's not those on the nice list who were given a gift. It's not those who got a good report from their elf on the shelf who get the blessing. It's those in darkness. It's those who have failed. It's the sinners, those who can't save themselves, those who couldn't be good enough. They are the ones who receive the gift. They are the ones who get the blessing. And so Christmas is a story of grace, of people receiving the very opposite of what they deserve, of being given blessing when they deserve to receive punishment. The message of Christmas isn't that God saw people being good, so he gave them a gift. It's that God saw people in sin, and he gave them grace. That's what we celebrate at Christmas, because we have all sinned. We have all turned from God and the life and purpose that he created us for. We've preferred to live our lives for ourselves rather than for him, that we seek our life and our worth and our pleasure in created things rather than the Creator. And so we should all know better than anyone that the message of trying harder to be better just won't cut it. Because there is something deeply wrong and broken in the world. And no matter what your spiritual or political or social or religious or economic background is, the one thing that everyone absolutely agrees on is the fact that things are not as they should be. That there is something deeply wrong and broken in the world. The Bible tells us that we were created to live in the presence of God as the people of God, to enjoy the blessings of his rule. And we were created to be in relationship with him, but rather than being with God, we've wanted to be God. We've wanted to be the ones in charge. We've all believed the lie that things would be better if just we were the ones calling the shots. And so rather than trusting and following him, we've turned to idols and sin. You see, when we sin, we aren't just doing something on the naughty list. We're turning from and rebelling against God. And so sin cuts us off from his presence. It breaks our relationship with him. You see, the simple truth is that the world is not what it should be because I am not what I should be. The world is not what it should be because we are not what we should be. See, you don't even have to be a Christian to recognize that. Because it's not just that we don't measure up to what God says. Folks, we don't even measure up to what we say. I mean, if you just listen to the standard that you hold everyone else to, all the times you say out loud or in your head, I can't believe they just, or how could she, or I can't believe he, or can't you just be more, or why won't they? Or if you wrote down all the times you were mad because someone else stretched the truth or hid something from you, or because someone else was too selfish. Now, we're typically really good at excusing ourselves and explaining why in that moment or in that situation the rules didn't really apply to us, how we were the exception to the rule in that moment when we didn't do any of those things. But if we just recorded all the times that we said or thought that in a month and applied our own expectation on ourselves, we'd see how by our own standard, we are liars, we are cheaters, we are manipulative, we are angry, we are selfish, we are hypocrites. You see, what that is our own hearts crying out, saying, you are not what you were created to be. You are not who you were created to be, and you can't fix yourself. The frustration and the division that we feel within ourselves and with others and with God, it all flows from the fact that in our sin, we want to be God instead of being with God. While the message of Christmas is that in his grace, God came to be man, to be with man, to be with us. So as we continue our series through John 1, we see what Christmas is all about, and we don't see it through the familiar details of the Christmas story like we see described in the Gospels of Luke or Matthew. We don't see the star and the shepherd. We don't see the manger or Mary. We see John telling us from a whole different perspective what happened on Christmas. That Christmas is all about the dwelling of God and the family of God. And it's about the dwelling of God, that by grace, God became flesh to be with us. And that Christmas is about the family of God, that by faith, we become God's children to be with him. God came to be with us so that we, for eternity, could be with him. That's the message of Christmas. And so let's look deeper into this dwelling of God. We're going to start in verse 14. And the word became flesh and dwelt among us. So we are told back in verse 1 who this word is, that the word existed from before the beginning, from eternity past, that the word was with God and the word was God, that he created and sustains everything so that nothing that exists exists without him. And he says that the word is life and light and that he shines in the darkness and he will never be overcome. And then John says that this eternal word, the eternal God who was with God the Father in the beginning, who created everything, who sustains everything, who is life, who is light, that God became flesh and dwelt among us. Now, one thing about John in his gospel is that he is incredibly careful with his words. He's very intentional with every word he uses, and particularly we see that in verse 14 with the word dwelt, because he could have used several other words that would have mean that he lived or that he existed or that he was present with us, but instead he uses the same word that was used for the tabernacle in the Old Testament. So literally what John's saying here is that the word became flesh and tabernacled among us. And now if that seems weird, we need to dig into that because there's a whole lot here. Now in Exodus 32, God had just delivered his people from slavery and oppression in Egypt. And after one miracle after another, he finally saved them by parting the Red Sea so that they could escape into freedom to be with him, to be his people in his presence, living under his rule. And God leads them then to Mount Sinai, where he gives them his commandments, or basically how he created them to flourish and to live and to enjoy his blessings. But while Moses was on the mountain, the nation of Israel had already turned from God. And they go to Aaron the priest and they beg him to make for them an idol. And so what they did is they took all their gold jewelry and he melted it down and then he crafted it into a golden calf. They make a false god that they could worship so that they could still have their sin. They wanted a god that they could worship and be with while still being with and having their sin. And so they rejected God and they settled for their sin instead of being with the one who actually saved them. And so God says to Moses, seeing this happen, this is a stiff-necked people. The image he's bringing to mind there is like of a donkey that won't be led by its master, who has a stiff neck, who's always fighting against everywhere that his master's trying to lead him, that he's trying to go the opposite way, that everywhere the loving master's trying to lead him to water, to lead him to food, that this stiff-necked animal is just fighting back and trying to run the other way. And so God is saying that these people, they keep turning their head, they keep turning their eyes, they keep turning their hearts away from me and toward idols and towards sin. And so he says to go to the land that I am giving you, that I will drive the people that are there out. But then in Exodus 33, verse 3, he says, "But I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people." And when the people hear that, they're absolutely devastated. They weep and they mourn because they realize what they've done. They realize that they could not be in God's presence because of their sin. And so in that moment, God's saying, go to the land. I'll give you the land. You can have the land, but you can't have me. You can go where I'm sending you, but I can't go with you. Because of your sin, that I can't be in your midst. I can't dwell with you while your hearts chase after other gods, because if I did, my holiness would absolutely consume you and destroy you. But in the midst of all this, we actually see what the tabernacle then was created for. To be a dwelling of God among a sinful people. Moses then cries out to God and says, if you go with us, you say you will consume us. But if you don't go with us, then God, please do not send us. And I realize that when Moses is saying this, they are out in the middle of nowhere in the desert. Moses is saying that, you say that if you go with us, that you're going to consume us and destroy us. But if you aren't going to go with us, then just please leave us here to die of thirst in the wilderness. Moses knows then that they need God's presence. That if they can't be with them, then they would rather die of thirst in a desert than drinking their fill in a land of plenty. Moses knows that they must have God, that nothing else will do. And then God says, yes, you have favor in my sight. You have my grace. And so then in this moment, in this interaction, Moses just goes for broke. He just goes all in, pushes all of his chips into the center of the table. And Moses says in Exodus 33, verse 18, please show me your glory. And then God says, I will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But he said, you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock. And while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. Now, it might seem confusing, but what he's saying there essentially is that you cannot see the display of my glory. It is too much for you. That in your sin, it would destroy you. But you can see my back, which basically means the after effects of my glory. You can see the lingering effects of my glory after they've passed by. You see, Moses is begging to see God's glory because in his heart he knows that that's what he was made to do, that he was made to see and rejoice in and worship God in all of his glory. So Moses just says, will you show me your glory? And God gives him a hint of it as he covers him up in a cleft in a rock. Passing by, proclaiming his name, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. And then after God passes by, hear this. Moses then prays, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people. And pardon our iniquity and our sin and take us for your inheritance. Did you catch that? God said, I can't go among you because you're a stiff-necked people. Moses says, Lord, you must go among us because we are a stiff-necked people. God says, I can't be in your midst because you are sinners. Moses says, because we are sinners, we have no other hope unless you come to be in our midst. The very reason God said that he could not be with them is the reason that Moses is begging that God must be with them. But how can these two realities be true? We can't be in God's presence because of our sin, and yet the only way we can be saved from our sin is by God's presence. We see that this had been God's plan all along because he then tells them to build the tabernacle, which was this huge tent in the presence of the people where God's glory would dwell. Hidden, kind of like Moses was hidden in the cleft of the rock. It would be hidden behind a curtain in this tent so that God's presence would be among his people and yet it would not destroy them. The tabernacle was the place where God's judgment on sin and his grace on sinners would meet so that wherever they would go, God's presence would be with them. But because they were stiff-necked and sinful, God's presence could not be displayed among them, that their sin had to be dealt with. And so the tabernacle was the one place where a sacrifice could be made to forgive sin so that you could be with and worship God. And so God's presence dwelt with sinful people so that sinners could be forgiven and be with God. That's what the tabernacle was. And so you see that the point of the tabernacle, what John is telling us now, is that the entire point of the tabernacle, the point of all those ceremonies, of all those sacrifices, all of it was to foreshadow, to point us toward the true tabernacle. When God would fully and ultimately come to dwell among his people, to be the tabernacle in the midst of sinners. John is saying Jesus is the true tabernacle. That Jesus is the place where the fullness of the glory of God dwells. That Jesus is the place where God's judgment on sin and his grace on sinners meet. That Jesus is the place where sinners can go and be with God. That's what he is wrapping up and saying in that one word, dwelt. That God has come to be with us, to be with sinners, to save us from our sin. So all the ways that God dwelt among his people before this were just temporary and incomplete, but at the birth of Jesus, they were fulfilled, they were surpassed, because his word was made flesh to dwell among us. One pastor explains it like this: thousands of years before Jesus, God proposed that there would be a tabernacle in order that there would be one who would fulfill the meaning of that tabernacle, who would be the true tabernacle for us. See, John is telling us that the God who dwelled among his people in the tabernacle, that he has come to reveal himself to be with us in a more perfect and personal way than we could ever have imagined, that Jesus has come to fulfill the tabernacle because he became flesh like us, so that he could be a sacrifice for us, so that the sin that cuts us off from God's presence could be forgiven and we could be welcomed in. So hear me. If you're a sinner, if you know that you have turned from God, that you aren't what you should be, if you want to be with God, if you want to know him, Jesus, the sinless one, took on flesh to be consumed by God's judgment, so that sinners, so that stiff-necked ones like you and me could be forgiven and be welcomed into God's presence. At Christmas, we celebrate that in Jesus, God's presence did not come to dwell with us in a tent, but he became flesh to dwell with us. That's what incarnation means. It means to take on, to become flesh. That the Word, God the Son, did not stop being God for one moment, but he added to himself, he became something that he had not been before. The fullness of God at the incarnation became the fullness of man. Fully God and fully man. That Jesus had was one person with two natures. A perfectly divine nature and a completely human nature. You see, Jesus wasn't just a man that was merely blessed and gifted by God. He wasn't just God appearing to be man. This was the moment that God wrote himself into history. When the uncreated God of the universe broke into his creation and became flesh. And so when he came to dwell among us, there's no blinding light, there's no blazing fire, there's no whirlwind or earthquake. There's just a baby born to a poor young woman and then laid down in a manger. Realize for a moment, that's how the God of the universe came into the world. Think about that. The one who for eternity has been high and lifted up is now as low as you could possibly imagine. He is a baby wrapped in dirty strips of cloth, laying in a manger, laying in a feed trough where animals eat. You see, God came all the way down to the dirt to be with you. He came all the way down to the filth to identify with us. He came to know and experience our weakness. He came as a baby. And so realize the depths that he sank to identify with you, that he can understand and relate to you in every way, just like we sing in that beautiful Christmas song, O Holy Night, that to our weakness, he is no stranger. He knows your weakness. And that doesn't just mean that he knows that you're experiencing it. He knows what it's like to experience what you're experiencing. He knows what it means to be tempted. He knows what it means to be abandoned, to be betrayed, to be hurt, to be hungry, to be miserable, to be a man of sorrows. He knows what it means to suffer. So this is the wonder that we worship and celebrate at Christmas. And if you think you don't really need forgiveness, that you could be good enough on your own, realize that the God of the universe literally had to take on flesh to come all the way down in order to save you. Nothing less than that could save you. Nothing less than that could forgive you. God literally had to come down to put on flesh, to take your sin, to forgive you. And yet, if you think you're doing fine on your own, if you think you don't really need forgiveness, that's what it took. But if you think that you are so bad, that you're so broken, that you're so damaged, that you're too far gone, that you're too lost, that nothing could actually redeem you, that no one would actually want you, realize what the God of the universe did to make you his own. That he came all the way down to the filth, to the dirt, to the mess, to save you, to forgive you, to be with you. You see, in Jesus, the God of all creation became like us. He was born of a woman like us. He was vulnerable like us. He was tempted like us. He experienced pain and sorrow like us. He was truly like us in every way except our sin. And yet in Jesus, we also have one who is truly and fully God. He was praised like God, worshiped like God, perfect and sinless like God, all-knowing and all-powerful like God, merciful and gracious like God. Jesus is truly God in every way. And so this is why he became flesh to dwell among us, to be the true tabernacle, because being a man, Jesus knows our weakness and he can be our example. And yet being God, he was able to live a sinless life and be a perfect example. Being a man, he is able to be our representative, our advocate before the Father, because he's faced every temptation that we face. And yet being God, he is the image of the Father and he truly reveals the glory of the Father to us. Being a man, he could be our substitute to take our punishment for our sin by dying in our place. And being God, he was able to be a perfect substitute to pay our punishment in full, forgiving our sins so that we could be accepted and welcomed into the presence of God. The fullness of God became fully man. The God-man, Jesus Christ, was born to save us. That's what all happened when the God of all creation was laying in a manger as a baby, unable to say a word, and yet by the word of his power, upholding the entire universe that he was created into. That the God whose power can accomplish anything didn't have the strength to hold up his own head. That the God whose love comforts the hopeless and the oppressed had to have his cries comforted by his mother's arms. And so the message of Christmas is not to try harder to be better. The message of Christmas is that your hope is not in your ability to reach up to God. It's in God's humility to come down to you. Jesus was born in the flesh so that we could be born in the spirit. You see, that's what John is telling us in verses 10 to 13. So let's close by looking at the family of God. Because Jesus didn't just come to dwell with us. He came so that we may become children of God with him. Verse 10. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. So even though Jesus created the world, he came into the world that he made, but it didn't know him. They didn't recognize him for who he was. And then in verse 11, John makes the point even more personal and intimate, because he says that he came to his own, which that word own could also be translated as he came to his home. But his own people, his home, didn't receive him. They rejected him. Jesus came home. He came to his people, but they wouldn't have him. You know, some of my absolute favorite videos to watch online are the videos of soldiers being welcomed home. And I usually can't make it through more than like 20 seconds of it before I'm like a mess. But there's just something radically powerful when you see the dad dressed up as Santa coming into his kid's classroom. And then all of a sudden the kid realizes that it's her daddy that she hasn't seen in a year. And just they're weeping, clinging to each other. Or when a big gift is under the tree at the holidays and a young wife cuts it open and then out pops her husband that she hasn't seen in months and months and months. Or the image I'm sure we've all seen of the young mother clinging to her toddler daughter in the airport on her knees just weeping. Like there's something really powerful about those images, about those videos, because we recognize that that is how it should be. That we should be welcomed home. That is how someone should be responded to when they come home. You run to them. You throw your arms around them. And in tears sobbing and streaming down your face, you just cling to them. And you say, is it really you? Are you really here? Are you really in my arms? And you have to just keep pulling them back to look at them again and again and again, because you can't quite realize the powerful weight of the truth that they are home with you. That they're really there. That's what presence means. And now it's hard to imagine, although I'm sure it happens, the tragedy for a soldier to come home only to find someone else there. Only to find a wife who's moved on, a family that's forgotten about them, or kids that want nothing to do with them. It's hard to imagine, but that's exactly what John is saying is happening here. He's saying that when God came into the world, when he came home to his people, the people he created for his glory rejected him and treated him like a stranger. And they wanted nothing to do with him. There is no neutral response to Jesus. There is no halfway. You either receive him or you reject him. And thankfully, we find out next that not all reject him, because John doesn't stop there. We see that the end of the story is not the tragedy of rejection, but the grace of acceptance. He goes on to tell us how to respond to the incarnation, how to respond to Jesus, how we are adopted into the family of God to become his children. Verse 12. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And so let's close by breaking this down, because right here, John is telling us what it means to be and how we become children of God. He starts off by saying, but all who did receive him. That there are those who receive him. And receive here is an intimate word. It's the same word actually used to describe Joseph receiving Mary as his wife. It's a word that communicates intimacy and total acceptance, a total identifying of yourself with someone else. To receive someone is to say that, yes, I am now with them. That we are wrapped up together, that we are connected and cannot be taken apart. But then what does that really mean from the faith perspective? What is that? What was it communicating for us with how we receive Jesus? Well, he explains it by saying that it means to believe in his name. And now name to us really just communicates like a tag, a way to refer to someone. But name in this culture meant all that a person was, the entirety of their identity with who they were in the very, very core of their being. And so John says that to receive them is to believe in them like that. And now to believe doesn't just mean that you believe he existed. It doesn't just mean to believe that something happened. When you believe in something, it means to put your whole life trust in the fact that that thing is true. So that all of your life then is then leveraged and built on the fact that this is true. I'm believing that this is the foundation that it will hold up. When I get on an airplane, I'm believing that this airplane can fly. When I live my life by faith, believing in something, I am banking everything else about my life on the fact that this is true. That this is what it says it is, that this is, that it can do what it says it can do. And so you live your life in light of that reality that you believe. And so to receive Jesus means to believe, to trust in, to live your life in light of the reality that he is God and that he became flesh to dwell with you so that you could be forgiven and accepted. So that you could stop settling for finding your life in sin or seeking your identity and your hope in idols. So that you could stop trusting in your own works and your own merit to save you. That's what it means to live your life believing in his name. But when you believe in Jesus like that, then it says he gave. That we don't earn, we don't deserve, we don't work for our way up to God. We don't earn being adopted into his family. He gives and we receive. That he gives us the right, an absolute, irrevocable right to become. To become something that we were not before, to become children of God. Folks, church, the Word became flesh to dwell among us, to tabernacle among us, to be the place where our sin would be forgiven so that sinners could be received and forgiven and brought into the presence of God so that we could be adopted, to be born again into the family of God. And we see that our birth into this family of God is not based on anything we do. It's not based on blood. It's not our family descent. It's not our ethnicity. It's not the family we were born into. It's not because of the will of the flesh or because of any want or desire of a person. It's not because of the will of man or because of their planning and all of their they're scheming and they're working. Our new birth, our adoption into the family of God is not due to anything in us. Our salvation being born into the family of God is a miracle of grace that we are given by the grace of God to receive and to trust when we believe in Christ. So I don't know all the baggage that you're carrying with this morning. I don't know what kind of baggage the idea of family or of God being your father brings up in you. But I can tell you this. I can tell you what God did to dwell with you, to take your sin, to cover you with grace, to forgive you, so that he could call you his own, so that he could make his home with you, so that he could give you the right to become children of God, that you could receive his grace and be adopted into his family. As C.S. Lewis said, the Son of God became a man to enable men and women to become sons and daughters of God. Let's pray.